which is on the 25th of December till the end of the year. You'll see on your chairs the flyer. You can turn it over and you'll see the first hour. You have a choice of lots of different things. There's a men's shiur, a women's shiur, and then there's a men and women's session, which I'm going to be doing this year on Kabbalah and meditation. And then followed by the second hour of different lectures and panels and things like that. So it's always a nice crowd, a nice exciting program. So come along if you're here in Sydney and join. It's always a very beautiful vibe. It's always just an opportunity to spend some of the holiday time educating ourselves. Also, the new Thursday in 2018, which by the way is going to be a very exciting Bina year, lots of new initiatives, lots of new programs, which you'll hopefully stay tuned with. But the Thursday morning, of course, will continue. And the first one is going to be on the 8th of February. I can't tell you the topic because I'm not quite sure yet myself. I'm working on it. So 8th of February. Okay, so we're 8th of February. We're working through the Ramban Nachmanides letter to his son. Remember, he wrote it when he was in Israel, writing to his son back in Spain. A personal growth letter, which we've been working through the various steps over the last 7 weeks. So far, we've covered all of these steps. Today, we're going to be doing the last two. But just first, just to review a little bit from last week. Last week, we revisited the whole concept of ego. We talked about the symbolic significance of the nation of Amalek, which was distinct to the seven nations because it represented ultimate evil, which is the source of all other bad character traits, which is the concept of egocentricity. We explained that ego lives in the subconscious. That's why it sometimes is not always conscious, and it drives many of our choices and decisions, which sometimes are done in a distorted way because they're being driven by ego. And as we explained last week, that ego can be very subtle. And we discussed the manifestation of ego and the concept of conflict of interest. Now, sometimes we're not egocentric necessarily, but we do have self-interest at heart, and it sways the way we think and the way we choose things. And the first step to dealing with that is the concept of awareness, just to be aware that it's there. Because not always can we eradicate self-consciousness or self-interest, but we can at least be aware that it's there and try and make it not interfere with our thought process. And the other thing, of course, is we just need to practice selflessness. And we talked about that the ultimate selflessness is not only giving. Giving is a good thing, but really even deeper than giving, we spoke about the Rachel and Leah's concept, is the idea of understanding another person. It's even harder sometimes than giving. There are many people who give and give, but not necessarily do they really read or understand or take into account the other person's feelings. And that's truly selflessness, and that's something we need to actually practice. And then we said, after all said and done, however, there's a part of our soul that's even deeper. We talked about the story of digging deeper. And at the very root of our neshama, the very root of our soul, is the spark of purity, which is selflessness. It's a spark which is connected to God. It's a spark where we include others. And sometimes when we deal with our ego, what we need to do is, although the ego is very deep, but we need to dig even deeper and find that spark of selflessness and spark of holiness in order to rebuild and to deal with those challenges. Okay. So today we're going to do the last two steps, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to do each one separately. And in each one there's different lines, so I'll just try and develop them a little bit. So the second to last step, he says to his son the following. He says, review your actions every morning and every evening, and in this way live all your days with the concept of tshuva. And then he mixes in, he says, cast external matters from your mind at the time of prayer. Now let's try and put that all together. Let's deal with the first sentence first. So the concept of self-reflection, we've talked about this before, but the only way, it is true to say that the only way that a person can grow is through what we call in Hebrew cheshbon hanefesh, which is the idea of self-reflection, honest self-reflection, honesty, self-evaluation. Now, before we continue, we need to point out a very important thing, and that is anything in the extreme never works. And often when some people are over-obsessed with self-evaluation, and then it's counterproductive and becomes, it achieves the exact opposite of what's meant to achieve, right? Because one thing we have to understand about self-evaluation and constantly reviewing and revisiting where we are and what our strengths and weaknesses are, that process is critical, but it's not the end in itself. The end is to get on with the job. The end is to give, the end is to help, the end is to do good, the end is to connect, the end is to achieve and accomplish a life of greater meaning throughout our time in this planet. But in order to do that, we have to self-assess. But when people over-self-assess all the time, they become self-absorbed. And obviously when you become self-absorbed, you don't grow. That's the whole point. So it achieves the exact opposite of true growth. So having said that, it needs to be designated times. He recommends a quick one, every morning, every evening. We know in Jewish tradition there's like every Rosh Chodesh, every beginning of the month, or the month of Elul before Rosh Hashanah. We've talked about this before, but it has to be designated times where people stop, take a step back, and have a look at themselves. Right? Have a look at themselves. There's an interesting story, and I mentioned it particularly today. Today is the 19th of Kislev, which is a significant day in the Hasidic calendar. 9th of Kislev celebrates the anniversary of the release of Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi. Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi was the first Chabad Rebbe, and he went about this mission of disseminating and publicizing and teaching Kabbalistic ideas in the inner part of Torah. And there was a lot of opposition, and eventually the Russian government caught up with him. Long story with a lot of misinformation. In fact, it was an interesting story. What the information that they were fed was that he was supporting the enemy, because at that time Israel, Russia and Turkey, of course, were tremendous enemies, and Israel was under the Ottoman Empire. And one of his campaigns was to send money to support the poor of Israel, and the Russian government thought he was colluding with the enemy, so to speak. So they incarcerated him, and on the 19th of Kislev, he was freed, and that marked also the beginning of even greater dissemination of his teachings. But one of the stories that happened when he was incarcerated was this. He was visited by a high-ranking Russian official who came to see who was this guy in jail. He'd heard that it's a big rabbi, an intellectual. He wanted to see for himself. So the minister came into the cell where the Alter Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman, was, engaged him in a conversation, and then he said to him, I'd like to ask you a question, a Bible question. He said to him, fine. He said, you know, at the very, very beginning of creation, Adam and Eve sin with the fruit. We've talked about this a number of times. And when they finish sinning, they become very, very self-aware, as the Chumash tells us. They realize they've messed up and they hide. And suddenly, they hear a voice of God who wants to speak to them. And God says those words, Ayeka, where are you? So he said, surely, if we believe in God and God knows everything, God didn't have to... It's not a hide-and-seek game. God didn't have to go and find out where Adam and Eve were hiding. God surely knew where they were, right? So the Alter Rebbe responded and he said what Rashi says, the famous commentator Rashi. And he said to him, because God didn't want to frighten them. So in order to engage slowly in conversation, in order to just ease the build-up a little bit, because he was going to give it to them over their heads, why they sinned and why they didn't listen to his instruction of not eating the forbidden fruit, so God wanted to warm them up, so he started the conversation where, good morning, where are you? Where can I find you to ease it and to make it softer? So the minister was a very scholarly guy. He said to the Alter Rebbe, he says, no, actually, I'm aware of that explanation. I know that's Rashi's explanation. He was a non-Jewish minister, but he'd studied a lot and in Rashi, and I'm looking for something different. Tell me something even beyond Rashi, tell me something deeper. At that point, the Alter Rebbe became very serious, and he looked at him and he said, I'll tell you what the explanation is. He said, the explanation is that it's not one question. It wasn't a question to Adam and Eve. It's a question to everyone. It's an everlasting, eternal question. That every once in a while we have to remember, he said, that God asks us, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you holding? What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? What have you accomplished? What are you learning? What are you learning from the past? What are you planning for the future? What kind of depth, what kind of meaning are you engaging in? What spirituality you are engaging in. It's an eternal question. And he went on and he did something amazing. The Alter Rebbe said, for example, he says, God looks at a person who is a particular age, and he named this person's age, who has a family with a particular number of children, and he said the number of children that this person had, and the guy was blown away, right? And he said, God is asking that person, Ayeka, where are you? And he's asking every single person throughout history, once in a while, there's that everlasting question, Ayeka, where are you? Because in order to grow, often life takes us in a very, very fast treadmill sort of pace, and we often don't stop to reflect. Now again, over-reflection is not healthy, but we need to reflect, because sometimes people just go day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, doing good things perhaps, but not actually taking a step back and say, hold on, am I maximizing my potential? Am I doing the things I'm supposed to do? Am I achieving? Am I strengthening my relationships? Am I engaging in a mitzvah? Or am I doing something meaningful and purposeful? I might have done lots of good things, and that's part of the reflection. But if we don't take a step back and we don't review ourselves, we don't assess ourselves, we simply cannot grow, because growth requires assessment, growth requires honesty, growth requires learning from the past. Moving into the future in a better way requires learning from the past. Now, one thing that's really, really important just to emphasize is an idea which I saw in an article written by Rabbi Ben A. And then I was thinking, that's a strange name. So I looked at the end of the article. It's on a website called Chabad.org, and I saw this very beautiful article. And at the end it says that it's the reason that it puts that name, it's an anonymous author. The A stands for anonymous. And the reason it's anonymous is because it's actually written by a recovering alcoholic who didn't want to put himself out there that way. And he talks about this idea of review, talks about cheshbon, talks about this idea of doing a self-inventory, which is actually very, very much part and parcel of the 12-step journey that people go through when they recover. And he draws on inspiration, he draws from a section in the Chumash, in Parashat Pekudei, which talks about the Mishkan, right? The Mishkan that was built in the desert, the tabernacle that God told the people to construct in the desert when they went out of Egypt. And it's a fascinating thing. It's a few chapters in the Torah, quite a few in great detail. We learn about the materials that we'll use. We learn about the construction process. We learn about the various vessels that were made, the structure, but then the candelabra, the ark, the table, the altar, and so on. Very, very great detail. When it all finishes, there's a portion in the Torah called Pekudei. Pekudei means an accountability, doing an audit. Moshe Rabbeinu does an audit of everything that just took place. Not that Moshe Rabbeinu was under suspicion, but Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, was teaching us a lesson. On a very basic level, a lesson of accountability. So he does an audit of all the materials that were used. With two parts of the process, there was two purposes. First of all, he took an inventory of all the resources, a tally, a total of everything that was donated, gold, silver, copper, wool, all kinds of things. And then what he did was, he went through a very big audit to understand exactly what each of the materials was used for. In other words, what vessel did it build, which structure did it erect, and so on and so forth. And he says, based on a very famous idea, that when God built the Mishkan, when God instructed that the Mishkan, the tabernacle, should be built in the desert, he said, there's a famous line in the Chumash, when he says, Vasuli Mikdash, make for me a temple, V'shachanti betocham, and I will dwell among them. That's what it says in the Chumash. And the commentary asked the question, the grammar seems strange. It should have said, Vasuli Mikdash, make for me a sanctuary, V'shachanti betocho, and I will dwell in it. Because the Mishkan was supposed to be a place for God's presence, to feel God's presence. It was supposed to be a place where God's presence would be manifested and revealed. So it should have said, make for me a Mikdash and I will dwell among it. I will dwell in it, not in them. But the commentaries explain that the message here was like this, that the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was just a model. It was a model. A model for each of us. Because each and every one of us, each and every one of us is a Mishkan. We build our own Mishkan. We build our own tabernacle. We have our head, our heart, the parts of our body, our emotions, our feelings, our cognition, our personality. And we're supposed to take all those gifts and the resources that God has given us and construct a Mishkan. Make a Mishkan. Make a dwelling place for holiness. Make a dwelling place for the divine presence. Use the gifts that God has given us to construct that Mishkan. So he says, if that's true, then we've got to follow the whole process of how the Mishkan was built. And just like how the Mishkan was built, part of the journey, part of the process was to do a thorough audit at the end of it. So too in our own personal Mishkan, we have to do an audit as well. Every once in a while, we have to stop and think, what are our talents? What are our personalities? What mistakes have we made? What good things do we have? And he goes on, as we've done before, as we've emphasized before, to very, very strongly emphasize that the self-audit is not about looking at our faults. That's where people go wrong. And that's why sometimes people are scared of doing an audit on themselves. An honest, brutally honest audit, a brutally honest self-assessment certainly includes looking at our weaknesses, but not only our weaknesses. An audit, just like in the Mishkan, looks at everything that we have, looks at all our resources, our strengths, what we've done with those strengths, the things we have achieved and the things we haven't achieved. The things we have achieved, are we achieving them properly? Can we do better? Can we improve? The things we haven't achieved, our weaknesses, we can learn from. Right? So an audit has to be an honest audit. An audit has to be, when we talk about reviewing our actions every morning and every night, as Nachmanides begs his son to do, it doesn't mean every night thinking about the terrible things we did that day. It could be thinking about the good things, thinking about the things we did accomplish, how we could do them better, should we continue them the next day, and of course looking at the mistakes that we might have made, because we're human beings and we make mistakes, because we're supposed to, and then trying to learn from them and doing better in the future. And he says, and then he, because it's a recovery, that's why I mentioned who he was, he says, look at this, and I'm going to read to you, he says in step four, that's step four of the 12 steps, we are enjoined to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. The purpose of this inventory is not only to be able to identify character defects that we wish to have removed, but also to become aware of our assets. A truly honest self-appraisal will reveal our positive qualities as well. As someone once put it, it's called a moral inventory. It's not called an immoral inventory. Right? We're not looking at the immoralities of ourselves necessarily. We're looking at the moral part of ourselves. We're looking at the things that we do have to learn how we can use them better. So that's what the first line of that step of that letter is referring to, that we have to constantly review. Let's just come back to it. He says, interesting thing, he says, and in this way, all your days you will live with teshuva. Now, I didn't translate that because the concept of teshuva is often very misunderstood, because normally it's translated as repentance. Repentance always sort of simplifies, we've done something wrong and we have to fix it. That's not what teshuva is. That's not what the word teshuva means. I mean, when we do things wrong, yes, we have to fix it. And it's certainly a part of teshuva, but the word teshuva, which we normally talk about at Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the word teshuva means to return, to reconnect, to grow, right? And that's exactly what teshuva is. Teshuva means learning from the past to do better in the future. That's what teshuva is, right? To take one step forward, to do something a little bit better than we did it before in all areas of our life. And teshuva means to grow every day, to grow every week, to grow every month. And that's why Nachmanides says to his sons that if you review your actions every morning and every evening, you will live a life of teshuva. And then, interestingly enough, he throws in this line and he says, cast external matters from your mind at time of prayer. What does he mean by that? And what's it got to do with the first two sentences? Because in order to do a self-review, we need to clear the space. Self-assessment needs, number one, a few things. It needs focus. It needs removing distractions. Self-assessment, the cheshbon, is actually a very difficult thing to do. First of all, you have to really be honest with yourself and be self-aware. You also have to have, if you do it at night, you have to remember what happened during the day. Have you ever tried this? Sit down at the end of the day and say, okay, let's go through the day. Very often you'll find you have no idea. I mean, big things in the day maybe, but I can't remember, where did I go, you know, what did I do, where did I go, who did I speak to, you know, who did I help, who did I insult. It's like a very thing to, it's actually a hard thing to actually be honest. You have to actually have a lot of focus. This concept is not an easy, it's not an easy thing, to be really self-aware. And it takes self-awareness, it takes that focus, clearing distractions, and he talks about doing it in the context of prayer. And the reason for that is because, as we've talked about many times, in order to put the self, negative self, the egocentricity to aside, there's only one way we can do that. And that is, we have to invite God into the equation. Because part of this concept is knowing our strengths. Part of this concept is knowing our infinite potential. Part of it is knowing that we can fix mistakes. Part of it is knowing that we're not defined by our shortcomings. We're not defined by who we are. We don't have to be trapped. And the only way to really conclude and to really realize and acknowledge that we don't have to be trapped is understanding that we have a spark of the infinite within us. And that's why Nachmanides says that part of that process is to remove distractions, to be self-aware, and to develop that consciousness in a context of prayer, because when you do it in the context of prayer, you invite God into the equation. And when you do that, it's a force higher than us, and then we can truly grow. Going back to the 12 steps, that's one of the concepts that is talked about so much in the 12 steps, that we've come to the realization that we have to surrender to a force that is greater than ours so that we can actually get out of who we are, because otherwise we remain trapped. Now, next week is Hanukkah, right? Beautiful time of the year, festival of lights. And in the context of growth and review and using what we have, using the assets in order to, our own assets, in order to grow and to learn from our past and to improve the future, I wanted to share with you like a 6-point formula that I think we can learn from Hanukkah. The first is that Hanukkah is connected with the number 8. Now, Kabbalistically, what's significant about 8? We are taught by the Kabbalists that the number 7 is a number, or 7 is always a special number. Shabbat is, for example, 7, right? But the number 7 is the perfection of nature. The physical world, or creation in general, was created in a cycle of 7. 7 emotions, 7 days of the week, 7 days of creation, in other words, 6 days in Shabbat, right? The Maharal of Prague, the great philosopher, points out that any physical object is connected with the number 7. You've got the top, the bottom, the four sides, and then the core, the inner, right? So when you reach the number of 7, 7 means we perfect nature. 8 represents, which is one more than 7, 8 is the number of that transcends nature, that goes beyond nature. It's normally a miraculous number, right? Hanukkah, of course, is 8 days, symbolizing the tremendous miracle that happened in Hanukkah, the oil lasting for 8 days. But Hanukkah, we know, is a festival of growth. It's a festival of generating light, and it's a festival of growth, because the whole idea is to illuminate the darkness. We'll talk about that in a moment, right? We also add each one candle each night, and so on and so forth. It's really about a festival of growth. But when we begin Hanukkah, we need to remember that it's a festival of 8. Growth means that we can go beyond ourselves. If we'd stick with the number 7, we would say, I can improve within myself, but I can't go beyond myself. The number 8 teaches us, no, we can go beyond ourselves. That's part of growth. All the things that Nachmanides talked about in his letter, which some people might find very, very difficult, to constantly talk calmly, not to get angry, to put away the ego, these are things that are very, very challenging for the personality of most humans. But yet the lesson we have from Hanukkah is that we're not bound by the personality of the human being, because we have that infinite spark within us, and therefore we can go the number 8. We can transcend the number 8 and go beyond nature, go beyond our own personality, go beyond who we are, really, and become a better human being. The second thing is very, very important. Big goals and small steps. I think I've shared this concept before, but it's an amazing idea. Over many, many, many centuries, this wasn't the original law of Hanukkah, but over many, many centuries, the custom developed on Hanukkah to light the Chanukiah, the menorah, the candle, right? To light the Hanukkah candles in a Chanukiah, in a menorah. It doesn't have to be done that way. One can take some tea lights or candles or bowls of oil, as it was done in Talmudic times, and just light them. You don't have to have a Chanukiah, but that's the custom. And every custom has depth, and every custom has significance. So I answered a question that, it's interesting, the first night, on the 8th night, the Chanukiah is very beautiful. When you see all 8 lights lit, it's a very, very beautiful sight. The first night, it's what they call in Yiddish a bit nebach. You've got this empty menorah, you've got one little candle burning there in this big menorah. The bigger the menorah, the more pathetic it looks, like it's one candle, but it's like this big menorah. But it's actually a very, very deep lesson. And this has got to do also with self-assessment. You see, sometimes people are worried to self-evaluate, because sometimes we worry to come to conclusions that we might find overwhelming. And therefore, we're not ready to engage in like drastic change. We're not ready to take on big resolutions, because maybe we're not going to work. The lesson of the menorah is very simple. That you have to look at the entire menorah. Yes, you can come to big conclusions. We have to have big aspirations, big goals, supernatural goals, but only do it one candle at a time. That's the lesson of the menorah. If you light all candles right away, it's not going to work. Right. But if you light one candle at a time, that works. But the one candle has to be in the context of big aspirations. We shouldn't be scared to dream about self-improvement. We shouldn't be scared to have ideals and have aspirations of where we should be getting to. Nachmanides writes to his son in this letter, never get angry. Right? And I don't think he meant this letter only for his son. Maybe his son was a great person who could achieve that about never getting angry. Most people can't. But we still read this letter. Because never getting angry is the menorah of 8. But we get there one step at a time. A little bit of improvement at a time. And that's one of the amazing lessons of Hanukkah. Big goals, but small steps. The other is a very interesting, just historic background of Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah at the end of the day? Hanukkah goes back to the whole concept we spoke about a few weeks ago when we talked about joy and happiness, right? And the difference between happiness and pleasure. Hanukkah at the end of the day was a very difficult struggle. It was a military war, actually. A military victory and miracle that was fought against the Greeks. They actually weren't Greeks, they were Syrians, but it was Greek culture that was the prevalent culture of the time. Greek culture was a very hedonistic culture. It was a very materialistic culture. It was a culture that, number one, was very sophisticated on the one hand, but on the other hand, was very, very determined to take spirituality out of any equation, to take depth out of any equation, to take meaning and purpose out of life, and to only focus on the physical, to only focus on the body. That's why they were famous for their gymnasiums and so on and so forth. That was the culture. That was the emptiness that came with Greek culture, and therefore that was the... That's why they wanted to stop the Jewish people at the time. They didn't want to destroy them. It wasn't like Purim, where Haman decided he wants to destroy the whole Jewish nation because he didn't want the existence of the Jewish people. Hanukkah is a very different festival. The background to Hanukkah was he didn't mind the existence of the Jewish people. He just minded their spiritual connection. He said we need to take you can exist, you can become part of our culture, you can integrate, but you've got to take any sense of depth and meaning and higher goal and higher meaning and higher purpose out of the equation. And that's part of the whole process of self-reflection, which is to reflect and ask ourselves the question, Ayeka, where are you in terms of, are you living a life just focused on yourself? Are you living a life where you're looking for happiness, but you're confusing happiness with pleasure, and therefore it's an outside-in model, as we spoke about? Or are you trying to achieve, trying to give, trying to help, trying to bring depth to our existence? That's the third lesson. The fourth one is illuminating the darkness. You know, it's interesting that the mitzvah of Hanukkah, lighting the Hanukkah candles, is to commemorate the 8 days where the candelabra in the temple burned with this oil that they only was good enough for one day, right? But you know that the menorah in the temple was kindled specifically during the day, in the afternoon. Hanukkah candles, the ideal time to light Hanukkah candles, is not during the day. Hanukkah candles, it's a bit challenging sometimes in the southern hemisphere, but Hanukkah candles are supposed to be lit after dark. Right, that's the real way of doing it, the real mitzvah. In shuls or in public place, they do it earlier a little bit, but at home it's really supposed to be done after dark. Why? Because the Talmud says the concept of Hanukkah candles is to illuminate darkness. In other words, the power of the number 8, the power of the little jug of oil, which we'll talk about in a moment, is that nothing is too hard to illuminate. Nothing is dark, too dark to make bright. Often the impediment to self-growth and the impediment to improvement, the impediment to self-reflection, is that we decide that this is too hard. This part of my personality is too dark to make light. It's too difficult to change. It's too negative to turn it into a positive. Hanukkah candle says that nothing is too hard. The power of the Hanukkah light is that we can transform anything. It's difficult. It's challenging. It takes time. It requires one step at a time. But nothing is too difficult to transform. That's the power of Hanukkah candles. That's why it's always interesting. The Talmud says, you know, there's different customs of how you light Hanukkah candles. Originally, when Hanukkah was first developed, so to speak, they actually used to light the Hanukkah candles outside by the door leading to the outside street. There are places in Israel where that's still done. The custom in the diaspora over time, because of persecution and fear of people vandalizing and so on and so forth, it became a custom to light it inside. And inside also the different customs, some people light it at a window, and some people light it at the doorway inside, right? Whatever the case, why am I mentioning this? Because when Hanukkah candles is lit by a doorway, it's supposed to be lit on the left side, not the side of the mezuzah. Right? Why? So very fascinating. We have a concept in Jewish law that we always do mitzvot with the right hand. Unless you're left-handed, because then that's your stronger hand. But, in other words, the person's left-handed, that's their right hand, so to speak. But normally we always do things with the right. You'll notice in shul, when they take the Torah out of the ark, they walk down the right side of the bimah. And they come back, they walk the other side, which is the right side of the bimah, going that way. When we shake lulav, we hold it with our right hand. Make kiddush with our right hand. Everything is done with the right. Why? Because Kabbalistically, the right is chesed and the left is gevura. And more importantly, with regard to this concept, the right is always a symbol of the world of holiness. And the left is always a symbol of where those experiences of unholiness can take hold, where they exist. So, not to be confused with right wing and left wing, has nothing to do with that. But right, right and left is right is the world of holiness, left is the world sometimes of unholiness. So therefore, when we engage in mitzvot, for example, right. When we engage in things that have to do with the Torah, we always use the right side, right hand. Why? Because we want to attract ourselves, we want to connect to the world of holiness, and we want to stay away from the world of unholiness, which is why mezuzah is put on the right side of the house. We want the mezuzah to protect the home, we want it to bring holiness into the home. It's done on the right side of the door, right? That's why everything is done with the right. But there are a couple of exceptions. One of the exceptions is Hanukkah candles. Because Hanukkah candles is so powerful that it's okay for the Hanukkah candles to enter into the world of the left. Because Hanukkah candles, the concept of Hanukkah is that sometimes we can reveal such a strength, such a power, that can even illuminate the world on the left side. It can go into the darkness. It can engage with the negative side of the world because it has the power to transform it. It won't be affected. There are many, many issues of holiness where we are told we have to stick to the right because if we engage in negativity, we'll become negative. We'll absorb that negativity. Hanukkah candles are not worried. We put it on the left side. We do it at night, right? All these things to do with darkness. In fact, also when people do it at the door, there's this concept of lining it lower than a certain measurement. Also, to go down to the depths, right? Because that's the power of Hanukkah candles. The power of Hanukkah candles is that it can illuminate even that which is negative, even that which is dark, even that which is in the world of unholiness. Then, number five is the concept of access your small jug of oil. What's the Hanukkah story essentially? It says that when the Greeks entered into the temple, they defiled the oil, right? For oil, for to light the menorah, you need oil. You need pure oil, pure olive oil, in the temple times that is. And when they came, they saw that the Greeks had come in and they'd broken and defiled all of the oil of the temple, and there was no olive oil left to light the candelabra. Now, just to give you the background, historic background, in those times it took 8 days to produce kosher, new, pure olive oil for the Chanukiah. Why it took 8 days is a subject of discussion. One of the explanations is that the place that it was done was 4 days away. So they had to travel there and back, so therefore 8 days. They looked around and they found, as the story goes, the small jug of oil which was intact and it had the seal of the Kohen Gadol. Right? What's the significance of that story? Now, incidentally, there's a very, very famous Hanukkah question, right? Very, very famous. It's called the question of the Bet Yosef. The reason it's called that is because there was a great commentator on the Shulchan Aruch called Rabbi Yosef Kara, and he wrote a very fascinating commentary on Jewish law. And in the laws of Hanukkah, he asks this question. And it's been well known all over history as the question of the Bet Yosef, on which, by the way, there are numerous, numerous answers. What's the question? He asked the question like this. We know that Hanukkah, we celebrate a miracle of a jug of oil that was only enough to last for one night, and it lasted for 8 nights, right? So he says, if that's the case, how many days is the miracle? 7. It could have lasted for 1 day. The miracle was that it lasted for the rest of the time as well. So he says, Hanukkah should only be 7 days then. Right? Why is it 8 days? This is the question. So many different answers are given. One of the answers, which is relevant to the discussion that I want to have, is that the first state was also a miracle. The miracle was that they found that jug of oil. It was hidden somewhere underneath. Could have missed it. The miracle was they found the jug of oil. The next 7 days was the miraculous lasting, the extra 7 days. That's why it's 1 and 7, which is 8. What's the significance of that? So in writings of Kabbalah, it explains the following idea. Oil represents the subconscious of the soul. Why? Just like the nature of oil is that it floats upon any liquid, it's kind of detached, it's aloof, it's higher. So oil generally represents sort of a higher part of our being, the oil part of our being. However, in the subconscious itself, there's two different levels. The subconscious is very strong. And that was the part, by the way, that the Greeks tried to defile. That's the significance of the history, that they went into the temple and defiled the oil. Because they didn't want, as I said before, they didn't want people to access the subconscious. They didn't want holiness. They didn't want spirituality. They didn't want that part. They wanted just a rational, logical way of existence. So they defiled the oil. And they had an effect, and it was a spiritual danger and a spiritual threat. The miracle of Hanukkah is that they found that one cruse of oil intact that had the signet, the seal of the high priest. What is that? So the Kabbalists say, as we spoke about last week, the ego also lives in the subconscious. And that's why it creates conflict and internal pressure. But there's something in the very depth of the subconscious which can never be defiled. That fifth level that we've talked about so often, that, say the Kabbalists, is the oil with the seal of the high priest. There's the one jug of oil that every single person has within their subconscious that could never, ever be defiled. It's that fifth spark, that fifth level of our soul that is always pure, that is always intact, that is always ready to be the catalyst for repair and rebuild, that is always there to for us to use to transform that those parts of our soul, those parts of our personality that have been damaged. The miracle of Hanukkah is that we access that part of the soul. And the miracle of Hanukkah today, as we continue to experience Hanukkah, is to access that small jug of oil. Because when we access that small jug of oil, then we can engage with the number 8. Then we can be miraculous. Then we can go beyond ourselves. But we have to access that part of the oil. You know, when we make the bracha on Hanukkah candles, one of the blessings is we say the bracha to light Hanukkah candles. Then we say, She'asan nisim la'avoteinu b'yom ha'mahem b'zman hazeh. Let's translate that. We bless God who performed miracles la'avoteinu for our forefathers b'yamim ha'mahem in those days b'zman hazeh in this time. Simply, the explanation of that is, he performed miracles for our forefathers by Yamim Mahim those days, Bizman Hazeh, at this time of the year. That's what it means. But a deep explanation is, we say, She'asan nisim la'avoteinu, God performed miracles for our forefathers, by Yamim Mahim in those days, but not just in those days. Bizman Hazeh, nowadays also. It's not a history festival. It's not like every festival. It's supposed to be a festival which we relive and we experience. And we light those Hanukkah candles on the first night. It's about accessing the jug of oil. It's about remembering that no matter where we've messed up, no matter what mistakes we might have made, we always have that jug of oil. We always have that small jug of oil that is intact and can be the foundation for us to access that power of infinity, that power to rebuild, the power to transform anything, any darkness, any negativity. And that's, there's certain times of the year that we have that energy, able to do that and to use it. But then, what do we do with that jug of oil? So the final and most important perhaps, no, I shouldn't say most important, but the final most important part of the formula is donuts. Can't get out of Hanukkah without talking about food, right? Why do we eat donuts? What's that? Because oil. It reminds me when I was a child. You know, certain things just stick in your head, right? So there was this fellow who used to come every year. He's a rabbi, he's a wonderful guy, human being, but he used to come every year and he loved my mother's cooking. And he used to always come for a Shabbat meal, more than one Shabbat meal. He'd stay there for Easter. I think he was collecting funds for, he actually was a great guy, he used to collect funds for clothes for poor people. He used to help many, many, many people. But he was a guy that he loved his food. He loved my mother's gefilte fish, you know, when he comes it's got to be like extra dose, you know. Yeah, most people eat one piece, if you like it, a second piece, but this guy would like it anyway. So, and he used to laugh at himself a little bit. He was like he was okay. So he said, he used to tell us about the guy that went on a diet, and he says he only eats things that start with an aleph in Hebrew. He used to talk Yiddish. He says, what do you mean the only things that eat olive? He says, ashtikel flesh, ashtikel fish, ashtikel chicken. Only eats things that starts with an olive, right? So they say the same thing when you talk about foods of the various festivals. And we have customs, right? So people always say, why do we eat donuts and Purim, on Hanukkah? Why do we eat Amitash and Purim? So there's two reasons. The first reason is because it tastes good. And then there's other reasons also, right? There's always a... No, so but the truth is, it's not true, because the truth is that Jewish customs have tremendous depth and meaning to them. And on Hanukkah, there's this minhag of eating donuts or sufganiyot, latkes, or whatever the case is. It's all about eating foods that are made with oil. Obviously, in moderation, check with your cardiologist before you eat too much, and so on and so forth. But a little bit won't hurt, right? What's this idea? I mean, we're not doing it to commemorate the miracle of the oil, because that's why we light the menorah every night. We light the Hanukkah candles every single night of the 8 days of Hanukkah to remember the miracle of the oil, right? So why do we have to eat things that are made with oil? And the explanation is actually quite deep. When we light the oil in the Hanukkah menorah, the Hanukkiah, that's about accessing the holiness of the oil. That concept I spoke about before, oil floats on top. It's a subconscious, a deep part of our soul. We access even that cruise of oil that is at the very, very depth of who we are that cannot be contaminated, right? That's an amazing part of ourselves to ignite and to access and to reveal. But the challenge always when it comes to these moments of inspiration and moments of holiness is to have an impact on the rest of the parts of the soul, to actually put it into practice. So what we do is, we don't just light oil or candles, because that's accessing the part of our soul which is subconscious on its own. We eat the donuts to show that part of our soul, the oil, has to then go into everything else. It has to go into the food we eat, it has to go into the, which is a symbol of the lives we live, the physical lives that we live. It's not just about a holy mitzvah, it's about impacting on every part of our life, that when we get up and we go through our normal routine of the day, which is eating and sleeping and entertainment and whatever we do during the day, business, whatever the case is, it's about living in those contexts, a life based on values, and the values coming from the oil, which is in permeating. The Talmud says that oil has two opposite properties. On the one hand, it never mixes with any other liquid. It stands aloof. It stands detached, representing that it's a different part of the soul. It's the subconscious. It's the depth. And yet, we know that if oil spills on something, it's what the Talmud says, mefafeya bekulo. It gets into everything. It's sort of just, everything becomes oily, right? You can't get it off anything. But that's the idea, is because it's that part of the soul which is so high and yet has the power to permeate the rest of our existence. And that's the symbolism, perhaps, of why we eat donuts, because we say that the oil can't just remain in the Chanukiah, it can't just remain in a context of a mitzvah or holiness or spirituality. The values that it dictates and the meaning and purpose that it brings to life has to be something that's going to then translate to every part of our existence. So that's all the concept of Hanukkah, and that goes back to the self-reflection that the Nachmanides urges his son to do in order to make sure that we keep on growing. And then he comes to the final step. And the final step, he says the following. Read this letter once a week, he tells his son, and neglect none of it. Fulfill it, and in so doing, walk with it forever in the ways of Hashem, so you may succeed in your ways and merit the world to come. In other words, you'll be rewarded that lies hidden for the righteous. But I want to focus on that last line, such an important line. Read this letter once a week and neglect none of it. Why? As we've said so many times, we know that the intellectual part of our personality is divided into three parts. Chachma, Bina, and Da'at, as we've explained many, many times. Chachma and Bina is the two stages of cognition, which we won't go into now, we've done it many times. But Da'at is when you connect to it. There's one thing knowing something, and there's one thing making it part of who you are. Learning, when we learn, particularly when we learn ideas, or we read things, or we read his letter, in order to grow, learning is not something we can just engage in ideas until we master the knowledge of those ideas. Because then it will remain as a tremendous concept and will never affect us. The only way for personal growth ideas to affect us is by repeating them, revisiting them from different angles, from different ways, coming back to them. Nachmanides says to his son after the whole letter, which has some challenges to it, he challenges him to reach quite high levels. Talk calmly, never get angry, all these kind of things, get rid of the ego. He says, you want to make this work? Don't just read it and say, that was a fantastic letter, amazing idea, and then maybe once a year or once in 10 years you'll have a look at it again, just to remind yourself. Read it every week, absorb it, connect to it, make it part of who you are. That's the idea of da'at. Da'at means connection. And when we learn these ideas and we keep repeating them, that's how we make them part of who we are. And one of the ways to do that is to learn them from different angles, and one of the ways actually to share them with others. Just yesterday I was talking to someone who was going through a challenging time, and she said that she was giving advice to someone else, part of a family who's gone through part of the challenge. And she said, you know, it feels funny because the advice, I know how to give the advice to someone else, but I'm having trouble experiencing myself. So she's like, I guess she felt a bit hypocritical. So I said, no, you don't have to worry. That's exactly what you're supposed to do. If you know it's true, it's okay to share with someone else. I told her, I do the same thing every Thursday morning. No, I do. I meant it seriously, by the way. Not exactly the way it came out, but right. I said, I share ideas that I haven't perfected myself. And one of the benefits I have is that it helps me, because I have to keep revisiting them, and I have to keep talking about them, and I have to keep discussing them and researching them and preparing them, and it's more beneficial for me than it is to you, I can tell you that much. So that's part of what repeating is. You have to keep repeating these things and keep growing, and that's the thing. So that's the, we'll just quickly have a look at, just before we stop. So just to quickly run through it, so basically Nachman Eli said, he starts off the letter by saying, Shema Beni, listen my son, be open to grow. Listen to what I'm about to tell you. Trust me, I'm your father. His first thing is, in a practical level, speak calmly. We talked about introducing that concept of calmness. That helps to banish the anger. He's talked about humility, which is so critical to the concept of banishing the anger, because anger comes from ego. He says, when you're humble, not only can you enhance your relationships, but then you can have a relationship with God. Yirat Hashem, fear of God. You engage with Him because you invite God into your life as part of humility. We talked about good character and happiness, how that leads to happiness, because happiness is an inside-out idea. And then he revisits the concept of banishing ego, because ego is a source of all evil. And he talks about communicating with humility, as we talked about last week. Understanding the other person, never intimidating another person, if one is humble. And finally, as we did today, the concept of self-reflection and review. So that ends this series and the year. And please God, next year, because we're going to fulfill what Nachman Eli says, to keep reviewing, we're going to keep going, hopefully, and keep growing from strength to strength. Thank you so much.